Президент США все-таки подписал
пакет антироссийских санкций. Дональд Трамп подписал без показного.
МИД России объявил об ответных действиях на санкции.
Персонал американских.
Reset interrupted, détente derailed, rapprochement rebuked. Any illusions about a thaw in U.S.-Russian relations were pretty much put to rest this week. So what happens now? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And joining us from Nantucket, Massachusetts, is Angela Stent, a former official with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Intelligence Council, and currently the director of Georgetown University's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies. Welcome to the podcast, Angela. Glad we could finally get you on.
Great to be on your show, Brian.
Great to have you. And joining us from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian foreign ministry official and a columnist for Republic.ru. Welcome back to the podcast, Vladimir. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Brian. Thanks.
So Congress has passed and President Donald Trump has signed tough new sanctions legislation. Moscow's retaliated by ordering the United States to reduce its diplomatic staff in Russia by 755 people. Vice President Mike Pence just completed a tour of Eastern Europe where he talked tough on Russia. And, oh, by the way, Russia is about to hold its massive Zapad military exercise right on NATO's doorstep. The last three U.S. presidents came to office with the stated intention of improving relations with Vladimir Putin's Russia, and all three wound up in the same place, but none faster than in this case. Mark, before we look at the view from Washington and Moscow, give us your bird's eye view. What do you see happening here?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think there's three key points I'd want to make. The first one is this is a very different type of sanctions regime than the ones we've seen before. And it's not just because of Congress's move to, in effect, put a child lock on the medicine cabinet so that the White House can't actually step in and bring them down itself. It's that whereas most of the previous sanctions have been about an act that can be reversed. We don't like the fact that you've stolen the Crimea. We don't like the fact that you've interfered in the Donbass. These are the sanctions that we are placing on as a result, and we will revisit them when you actually pull out of the Donbass, pull out of Crimea. This is not. This is just simply basically punishment for a past deed that cannot now be withdrawn. So I think we're definitely, in this respect, actually moving into, if not a war without end, but certainly a much longer, more open-ended conflict. Second point is actually it's worth saying, the relative weakness and tardiness in some ways of the Russian response. A swinging cut, absolutely, to the diplomatic representation in Moscow. Though, of course, it's worth mentioning that at the moment, so much of the embassy's political level activities and economic connections and so forth are basically been in hiatus anyway. That although clearly this is going to affect things like sort of visa services and such like, you know, it's something that is essentially going to impact the State Department, but not really the grand scheme of things.
And it's going to result in Russian employees being fired, essentially, and being let go.
Yeah, but I don't think Putin will be weeping bitter tears for them. And the third thing I think it's worth just sort of touching on is the European dimension. Because, again, this is something that obviously sort of Europe is concerned about. There is talk of language about Europe being consulted before the application of sanctions. But in many ways, this is precisely about internationalizing a very specific American grudge with Putin, with European companies potentially put in the middle. And therefore, it's going to be interesting to see how that is managed. Because up to now, I think what has been striking and encouraging has precisely been the level of Western unity on dealing with Moscow. This, unfortunately, perhaps understandable reasons, but nonetheless, unfortunately, potentially brings some grit into the machinery.
Yeah, well, Nord Stream always was a little bit of grit in all of this machinery, and now it's just kind of being brought to the forefront. I want to follow up with you, Mark. In a commentary on CNN this week, you argued that Putin's response to the U.S. sanctions, ordering cuts in the U.S. diplomatic presence in Russia, betrayed a weakness in his position. Would you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's first worth mentioning that these were essentially clearly the sanctions that had been prepared as contingencies after December's move by Barack Obama to expel Russian diplomats and close two of their compounds in response to election meddling. And at that time, they made a big deal of their forbearance, and they had such high hopes in the president-elect and so forth. So, I mean, essentially, they stuck their response in the deep freeze, and they just popped it out, dialed up the numbers to the sort of maximum feasible, and then just plopped it into the microwave. So, you know, it clearly is just something they had lying around. But if one thinks of the other kinds of options, it's actually striking how limited. And in terms of economic sanctions, what could they do? Sure, they could hit American companies that have significant market presence in Russia, whether it's Apple or Google or Microsoft or MasterCard. And
well,
so
I would add that that's a bit limited. I was looking up the numbers, and Russian-American trade, you were talking about less than 0.1% of U.S.
Precisely. It's going to affect the companies concerned only to a limited extent. But also what's really interesting is, I mean, precisely the people who use these services. I mean, taking the iPhone away from Russians. Now, if anything is going to get crowd mobs on the streets of Moscow, it would be that. So, I mean, I think that it's limited. You know, there is very little there is nothing, frankly, that America requires. Where you do have key things, it's, for example, they could refuse to send American astronauts to the International Space Station. But as I understand it, I heard from someone just this morning that Roscosmos was actually lobbying First Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin, who is in charge of the military industrial complex, precisely to try and avert any such moves, because they're worried that basically they get almost $1 billion from NASA over the next 18 months. So I think, you know, economically, that there's nothing that will not have much more of an impact on Russia. And likewise, geopolitically. Sure, they could be a little bit more, even more recalcitrant over Syria. But that is not going to be in a position, unless they're actually willing to strike at U.S. forces, which is a war-fighting scenario. Right. There's really not that much they can do that they're not already doing.
They've played that card.
North Korea, they could be more recalcitrant over North Korea, but that might actually alienate Beijing, which really matters. So, you know, everything has this significant price tag attachment. Even in Ukraine, you know, they could out of pique choose to escalate, which is, first of all, going to sort of advance any moves to provide military assistance and so forth. And also the Ukrainians themselves are fairly sort of well placed for that. So in some ways, I'm struck by the fact that although it might well be that Putin will decide for the future that he has to do something, even though he will take a hit for reasons of political credibility. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, there is nothing that is, as it were, not more expensive for Russia than it is for the target. And in fact, the very fact that we had on Sunday Putin indicating that unless things change, he's not envisaging any other sanctions. Mm. It was pretty much a reflection of that.
It's just about not looking weak, as you put it.
Exactly. I mean, and because it did have this big number attached to it, 700, right. It's a big cut.
Which is a deceptive number, I would imagine.
It is deceptive, but the point is it grabs the news cycle for a while, which
sure
is what
did.
Was intended.
Right. Angela, what's the view from Washington? Is the foreign policy establishment there gearing up for a protracted conflict with Moscow? Vice President Mike Pence's comments in Europe this week certainly seem to suggest so.
Well, there is not one view from Washington, and I think you have to bear that in mind. So, you know, on the one hand, you've had a coalition now of Democrats who blame Russia for Hillary Clinton's loss, teaming up with Republicans who want a tougher policy toward Russia, and obviously Mike Pence represents that, and they have this alliance now in Congress, and they've got the sanctions through, and they want to do everything they can to punish Russia. So that's one view from Washington. And there are some very vocal, you know, ex-Obama officials who are very much backing this. And, you know, and we gather that Hillary Clinton's memoir that's coming out very soon called What Happened, that she's going to say some very tough things about Russia. So that's one view. Then on the other extreme, you have President Trump himself and his small group of advisors within the White House who still believe that we can make a deal with Russia, that Russia is our natural ally against the threat from Islam. And so you had Steve Bannon talks about it, one of his key advisors, and that group still believes that they would like to advance the relationship with Russia. And you saw that again last night. President Trump had one of these campaign-style rallies in West Virginia where, you know, he just blamed the Congress for tying his hands and that we need to move forward with Russia. And then I think the third group is in the middle. And there I would say that's Rex Tillerson, it's General Mattis, McMaster, you know, the National Security Council, Defense Department, State Department, that believe, yes, we have a problem with Russia, and yes, you know, we have to stand up and we have to make sure that we don't have other major cyber intrusions, but there are areas where we have to work together with Russia. Syria is one of them. You know, Mark's already mentioned them. North Korea actually may be sitting down and at least beginning a dialogue on cyber rules of the road, although that's very complicated, and that therefore we have to try and push forward an agenda where it's in our interest to work with Russia. I mean, Tillerson has said this explicitly, you know, push back where there's aggression, figure out where we should work with Russia, where we have common interests, and then thirdly, you know, aim for strategic stability. And I think that that sort of third group is where a lot of the foreign policy establishment is, and I would say a lot of the commentariat too. So at the moment, it looks as if, you know, the tough line will prevail. But even while those sanctions were passed and everything, there are contacts that, you know, the chiefs of the general staff have been talking to each other. So there are, you know, various working groups also with Mr. Ryabkov and our Deputy Secretary of State moving forward. So I think what you'll see is, yes, the rhetoric will still be tough and there won't be that much movement very quickly, but there's still an understanding, and also on sort of the issues of nuclear weapons and things like that, that we have to try and move forward on some of these areas where we have vital national interests involved.
Yeah, no, when I listen to you, Angela, it seems to me groups one and three sound similar to each other, differences only in kind of nuance, and which it suggests to me that any notion of any grand bargain is probably off the table now, I would imagine, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, but I think grand bargains usually don't work, and we can go back the past 25 years and see where they didn't work. So I think grand bargain is off the table. I think what you could hope for the best would be a kind of slow and really painstaking normalization. And yet the interesting thing is that the two presidents, Trump and Putin, in their own ways, want to leave the door open for something different. I mean, I know with interest that in Russia, President Putin himself has said, you know, there, you know, I hope that we can still work together. And he's left it to, you know, Prime Minister Medvedev, Foreign Minister Lavrov, to say much tougher things. Mm-hmm. And in the sense, you have a mirror image of that in the U.S., but you still have a sense that these two presidents, if they could, would try and do more together.
Right. Now, sticking with you just for a moment, Angela, you were quoted in the New York Times this week as saying that Putin had hoped the Trump administration would treat it like a superpower, like the Soviet Union. Now the Kremlin's disappointed and also unnerved by the unpredictability of the White House. So they're effectively reverting to old habits. I hope I paraphrased your quote accurately there. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I mean, I think it's not only the Trump administration. I think it's been clear for some time that what President Putin would like from particularly the U.S. is to recognize Russia is a great power. It has legitimate interests. We may not agree with those interests, but we should be respecting those interests and dealing with Russia as such and not trying to impose on it, you know, what we think Russia's interest should be, right? This has been a theme with Putin for a long time. And I think the difference is he understood that with Obama, that was not going to be possible. Obviously, the relationship between Putin and Obama got off to a bad start, and it never recovered. And I think they hoped that when the Trump administration came in and listening to what President Trump said when he was a candidate, that they would get this kind of recognition. We're two great powers. We can make a deal. And I think now, realizing that yet again, that's not going to be possible. And there were hints during the campaign when Trump basically said, well, you know, Ukraine, that's really of great interest to Russia, by the way, which is what Obama also said in a different form a couple of years ago. But that there would be a recognition that, you know, Ukraine, that issue is going to be more or less off the table because we agree that the U.S. is going to pull back from it. That's not happening at the moment. So, yes. So you get a flexing of muscle, military muscle. I think we're going to talk about that soon. You know, the counter-expulsion of quote-unquote diplomats, and you've already gone over that. Most of those are Russians that work at the U.S. Embassy and consulate, so it's not really an expulsion of diplomats. But those are things that we've been doing, you know, for decades during the Cold War and now. But it's, you know, a sort of a policy of strength, and if the U.S. isn't willing to recognize what Russia would consider to be its legitimate interests, to push forward with them and you know, have a more threatening pose.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the view from Moscow, Vladimir?
Ryan, I think for Moscow, the problem with the new sanctions is that they significantly reduce the diplomatic flexibility that Moscow might have employed with the Trump administration. I mean, granted, both today and before that, under the Obama administration, the sanctions relief was predicated on specific Russian reversals of previous policy on Ukraine, Crimea, and Eastern Ukraine. And that is the case today, but the new legislation introduces a degree of public spectacle into that. Mm. And I think that kind of reduces the incentives and reduces the flexibility that Moscow might have had to pursue some creative diplomacy with the Trump administration, particularly on Donbass, that might have resulted in some kind of a deal that would sort of fuzzy up this notion of Russian political policy reversal that would
face saving,
to save face.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now with Congress sitting in judgment on whether this policy reversal is satisfactory or not, I think it kind of reduces the incentives for Moscow to pursue those kinds of deals. If you remember, Secretary Tillerson was when he was voicing his opposition to the sanctions legislation, one of the arguments that he had was that we shouldn't be pinned down to Minsk implementation. We should not preclude the possibility that the Russians, that Moscow and Kiev might reach some kind of a new deal between themselves that would be satisfactory to the parties. And why do we have to continue with the sanctions that would be tied to Minsk that would no longer be relevant? I think that's the diplomatic concern that Moscow is having. Mm-hmm. Now, the kind of political deal-making with the Trump administration would be essentially impossible. And there is a domestic dimension to that. If sanctions relief is so strictly predicated on specific reversals and policies, there is a tendency right now in Moscow to interpret the call for those reversals as some kind of an effort to engineer regime change in the Kremlin, assuming that policy reversals would come from the regime change. And that kind of eliminates any free space for creative diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Because you can't come up with options and policy proposals if you're dealing with the environment that this is all about, regime change.
Mm. Now, what is Moscow's aim given these new realities? What's Moscow's next steps? What are Moscow's next steps?
Given the rather restrained response that the Kremlin gave to the sanction to passing out the legislation, I think the impulse would be to wait and see how those sanctions would be implemented, how the Trump administration would actually go about implementing what Congress gives them as a discretionary, not a mandatory authority, mm-hmm. right? And it'll be interesting to see how the Trump administration applies this legislation to some of the Kremlin's pet projects, like the pipelines to Europe, gas pipelines to Europe.
In your column, go ahead.
They will try to find fissures between the different U.S. policy groups and different U.S. government mm-hmm. agencies. I think right now the media response is to infuriate Trump with congressional action that limited his presidential authority. I think mm-hmm. there is a clear effort to play up to Trump, whose stature has been diminished by his foes in Congress.
So Medvedev's comments yesterday were a psyop?
To a certain extent, yes, but it's coming from Russia's prime minister.
Yeah.
that's a specific statement, so it's not exactly a psyop.
My initial interpretation of this is, wow, he just doesn't understand how American democracy works.
I don't think that has anything to do with a lack of understanding of American politics. It's a deliberate push to engineer a collision, to deepen the fissures within the U.S. government.
And also that fits in with the timing.
Also, yeah. Try to watch how the Europeans react and whether there could be a possibility for some sanctions erosion, particularly the European sanctions erosion, because as we all know, it takes for the Europeans, it takes unanimity to prolong the sanctions.
Yeah.
To vote on extending the sanctions every six months. And so I think the Russians' negotiating position with the Europeans has just improved with this legislation.
Although there's different interpretations of that. A lot of people are now arguing that this really isn't going to drive the wedge between the Americans and the Europeans. A lot of people think it does, that if you look at the fine print of the bill, it doesn't really pose such a threat to European economic interests as was first imagined. Although we'll see how that plays out anyway. Vladimir, in your column for Republic Rue this week, you seem to indicate that Putin wasn't giving up on some kind of bargain with Trump, some kind of detente on his terms, of course. But Vice President Pence's rhetoric in Estonia, Georgia, and Montenegro this week seems to suggest that's not in the cards. And also, if you look at the U.S. sanctions bill, as you indicated, it means that this president or any future president in the U.S., for that matter, will need a broad bipartisan consensus before lifting sanctions on Russia. So is Putin kind of grasping at straws here? Does he really think he can come to some kind of reach some kind of a deal with Putin in these circumstances?
Well, under the circumstances, what Moscow's left is to have hope springs eternal. Mm-hmm. What else do we have to do? So abandoning hope would be the last thing that remains on the table. But I think there is some perception, perhaps erroneous, but there is some perception that Trump is still not done with the U.S. Congress, and he might regain his capability and his to act as a commander-in-chief and as a strong executive. And under certain circumstances, if we play the cards right, we might engineer some kind of a case that would allow Trump to go to Congress and make the argument that Russia qualifies for certain sanctions relief. Mm-hmm. I think we see very clearly this effort to at least maintain a very specific area of cooperation in Syria to engineer de-escalation and some political process in Syria that would essentially allow Trump to say, well, Russia is a cooperative actor. It's not really a bad actor. We need to cooperate. So there'll be specific areas where Russia might actually play along with Trump and entertain the hope that this would result in some kind of a larger deal that would take Russia's concerns into account. But yes, I agree. It has just become extremely more difficult. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
to engineer.
Let's go to Angela with this. You heard Vladimir. I mean, is this an
sure.
erroneous hope on Putin's part? If indeed this is his hope, do you envision a scenario in Washington in this environment where that's possible?
I think it's going to be very difficult because don't forget, while all of this is going on, we now have the intensification of the investigations into the links between the Trump family and different Russian people and entities, and then apparently a broader investigation by Mr. Mueller, the former head of the FBI, into business contacts between the Trump Organization and different Russian entities that go back way beyond or before the election. So we understand that Mr. Mueller has just convened a grand jury in Washington and that they're going to be investigating specifically the meeting last year between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, the lawyer Natalia Veselitskaya, and some other Russian attendees there. And so even though President Trump himself keeps criticizing this and saying, you know, it's a witch hunt, this is going on. And so as long as all of these domestic investigations go on, and this could take at least a year, I still think it's going to really limit President Trump's room for maneuver. Even if we didn't have the sanctions bill, his room for maneuver was already very, very narrow because of these constraints. And it's gone to a point now where the U.S. Congress is considering legislation that would prevent the president from firing Mr. Mueller, the head of this investigation, which he has hinted that he might like to do. So I think there are these domestic constraints there that will limit any ability, again, to move forward. And I agree, you know, I'm sure that President Putin would like to find a deal. And as I said before, I think that President Trump would too. But I think in practice that would be very difficult because he's got the Congress and, you know, arrayed against him on this and the other branches of government looking very warily on it.
What do you think of the potential for driving wedges into the U.S. establishment, as Vladimir suggested? That would be more of a strategy of disruption than one towards getting a grand bargain. But do you think that will have any effect in this environment as well?
Well, I think there are already wedges there anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a result of whatever happened last year during the election campaign is you have a lot of infighting, backbiting. I mean, the fact that, for instance, yesterday somebody leaked the transcript of conversations between President Trump and the Australian Prime Minister and the Mexican President, where he does not appear in a very flattering light. I mean, this leaking is going on. I've never seen this or remember. So those fissures are already there. I do think, and I think it's important to note this point, you know, in the sanctions bill, which is potentially quite serious, is the U.S. Congress driving wedges between the United States and Europe. So this is the third time that I can remember that a U.S. administration, beginning with President Kennedy and also President Reagan, for instance, has tried to stop its European allies from participating in pipeline projects to bring either Soviet oil, as it then was, Soviet gas or now Russian gas, to Europe. And these policies have never worked. But it's one of the things that the U.S. Congress likes, and the executive, too, likes to try periodically, forgetting that maybe it didn't work last time. And even though, as a result of the European concerns about this, some modifications were made to the sanctions bill, and even though the president does have the discretion to see whether these things are implemented or not, you know, we now have a bill that potentially could make it, very difficult for U.S. companies to even repair pipelines in Russia or other countries in the former Soviet space if a Russian company is involved in it more than 33%, or obviously would make it difficult for our European allies again, you know, to get involved in an energy project, for instance, Nord Stream, where more than a 33% is owned by a Russian company. So, I was reading just today another very tough German editorial on this. I mean, the Germans are very upset by this, and there is the potential that as a result of this, the EU countries, even though, you know, at the moment they've been united on this, could say, well, if we're going to incur extraterritorial sanctions against us, then why should we have the sanctions regime? So I think you have the potential there for fissures between U.S. and Europe, and something that obviously the Kremlin must be looking on with great interest if this bill isn't implemented correctly. But I think the other obvious point to make is we don't quite know how this is going to be implemented and how this is going to work. But the threat of something of these fissures happening is definitely there.
And one would expect that the back channel diplomacy with the Europeans is fairly active right now to assuage any concerns. The another piece of this is I read a very interesting piece in Atlantic Council this week reviewing Agnija Grigas's new book on energy policy about basically the U.S. is in fact moving forward at a very fast pace with energy exports to Europe within LNG. Will remains to be seen how much that's going to truly change the equation.
But Brian, that's much more expensive.
Yes,
I mean Russian gas is much cheaper than U.S. exports of LNG. I mean, when President Trump went to Poland a couple of weeks ago and touted the fact that we're exporting LNG to Poland, it's an infinitesimal amount,
right,
you know, of what Poland's energy needs are.
Mark, I see you're writing, or you were writing, and when you're writing, you're about to say something.
Just a few thoughts. I mean, just to pick up, first of all, on that point about LNG, I mean, exactly, LNG is more expensive. And that, frankly, leads in part, and without, you know, being too conspiratorial, people wondering if there's also a dimension to these sanctions, which is exactly trying to basically price out the Russians politically when they can't do it economically and create new markets for American gas. Whether that's real or not, and I don't think it's impossible.
Well, I could see that getting some traction with the European left, for example.
Well, no, I mean, actually, I think, ironically enough, actually, the European right also has a sort of a tradition of regarding Americans as the indispensable military ally, just not ones to be trusted. So, I mean, I think there is scope. I mean, yes, a little bit of wiggle room has been built into the sanctions legislation as a result, and there's all kinds of current sort of quiet diplomacy about don't worry, we're going to be sensible or whatever. I'm not entirely convinced at the moment the mood in Europe is to be reassured by the sense of it's all right, Washington is going to be sensible and nuanced about this at the moment. But I was actually thinking, it's interesting, exactly, we go back to old language as well as old things like détente and such like. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting sort of side effects of all this is no one, I think, anymore would call Russia just a regional power.
True.
It's interesting that the objective status of Russia hasn't changed at all. Its GDP has not suddenly sort of ballooned.
Oh, it's still less than Texas.
Yeah, I mean, for all these things. But nonetheless, I mean, even though we now talk about Russia more in the language of a problem, a challenge, a strategic threat, etc., ironically enough, we have, in that respect, made Russia great again. Now, I think, again, it's a question of the costs and the sustainability for Moscow. And I think this is one of the interesting things that we've been having this discussion very much about how America sees the situation, how the American political elites are conspiring, whatever. One way or the other, I mean, I think it is clear that Trump, who is, let's face it, interested in Trump, is not going to be in a position to be able to make any kind of substantive deal with the Russians without having to burn a lot of political capital that he's hemorrhaging at the moment, for all kinds of reasons, particularly the ones that sort of Angela had mentioned. And so I think, you know, for more and more, this is why I feel we are in for a sort of a long-term process. This is not the 1980s, because there's a parallel with 86.
Yeah, no, I want to come to that in a bit.
But nonetheless, it's more the 70s. This is the Brezhnev era.
Although that was an area where the Soviet Union was really strong. What I wanted to pick up on this a bit, Mark, and go and kind of broaden the aperture a little bit. I mean, we have had three U.S. presidents who came to office with a stated intention, three very different U.S. presidents. I mean, you cannot get three presidents more different than George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. You can, but you'd have to try pretty damn hard, right? Three presidents came to office with very identical goals vis-a-vis Russia. Improve relations, right? Bush looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. Obama pushed the reset button. Trump was going to work together with Putin on some grand deal. Is this a problem without a solution? I mean, this is what I keep coming back to, because Russia wants something, I think, that the U.S. can't give, right?
Well, Putin wants
Putin,
something.
Okay, that's fair. Putin's Russia wants something the U.S. cannot give.
I think that now, I mean, I think that they're probably, again, with glorious hindsight, there may have been certain scope earlier to have achieved something, again, not a perfect meeting of minds. Putin's Russia's interests are not those of the West's. But that doesn't mean that we can't reach some kind of modus vivendi. I think the problem is precisely that actually for Putin now, it is not just simply a matter of having a shopping list of demands that some can be sort of ticked off and others accepted not. It's not like you can say, well, okay, I don't get the sphere of influence that I think we deserve, but at least I have got something else or whatever. I think the trouble is this has become a package. And because he sees this as fighting back against a civilizational struggle, a West that is hypocritical, that is actually trying to undermine, not just in geopolitical terms, but in sort of the sort of whole sense of, you know, making Russia Russian. I think this is why he's in a position where there is actually very, very little scope. So I think almost the problem has precisely been we have had three different, and in different ways naive, attempts to improve relations, mm-hmm. which have actually, you know, sometimes for just bad luck, sometimes for just bad planning, not worked out. And I think it has created precisely a sense amongst Putin's cohorts, a belief that, well, this is what the Russians have to cope with. They have to cope with an America that will forever talk positive, inclusive language, but in fact it's not interested in it. There is a demonization on both sides.
But it's always been the case that Putin wanted something. Putin wanted something Bush couldn't give. Putin wanted something Obama couldn't give. And Putin wants something that Trump cannot give.
I think Putin, like so many authoritarian leaders, has essentially become increasingly over time a caricature of himself. I think that probably in the early days of options, I think there was greater scope. I mean, even though by the Munich speech and 07, I mean, it's clear that sort of Putin was turning against the West. I think at that point it was still, shall we say, a pragmatic rather than an ideological struggle. I think it has become ideological, and that is precisely what makes it so intractable. Mm-hmm. So I agree. I mean, I don't see how at the moment this can be fixed under the current incumbent of the Kremlin. Mm-hmm.
Vladimir, would you agree?
Well, I largely agree that it's right now it's a problem without a solution. I think another dimension of that problem is that the goalposts, the contents of that potential deal keep shifting and keep changing. If you remember, under the George W. Bush administration, Putin didn't really object to NATO's enlargement into the Baltics and to the U.S. withdrawing from the EBM treaty now.
Did he not object, though, or did he just acquiesce?
He acquiesced, but he didn't make much of a fuss about it.
He didn't show up in Prague.
On a policy level, it was not really visible in Moscow at that time that we didn't really have much of a concern over NATO enlargement into the Baltics. It was after 2007 and 2010 that the issue became much more significant. And then the ABM, the ABM treaty and the ABM deployments into Europe became a major concern. And I think clearly on things like ABM and the arms control regime, there could be a meeting of minds if the two sides really put an effort into working together. But right now, that doesn't seem to be likely. I think another problem with this is that when the Russians make trades, make a pitch for a trade, they sometimes miscalculate and might wind up with the different ends of the bargain. For instance, we went into Syria to get our interests respected in Ukraine. And what we might be having right now is that we would get Syria and not
Ukraine.
Right? So it's largely a case of be careful what you wish for. Uh-huh.
Now, another thing I wanted to bring up before we shift into the second part of the program is what I've been calling the echoes of 1986. These diplomatic expulsions that weren't really expulsions have made everybody recall the expulsions of 86, the expulsions and counter-expulsions of 86. And it made me recall comments Ambassador Daniel Freed made in a briefing before the U.S. Helsinki Commission, which I participated in last month. Ambassador Freed said essentially that after periods of foreign adventure, and this is you don't have to be much of a student of Russian history to agree with this, but after periods of foreign adventure, failed periods of foreign adventure, Moscow tends to look inward and tends to reform and tends to seek rapprochement with the West. Not necessarily in its own terms, but often on the West's terms. This was the case after the Crimean War, after the Russo-Japanese War, and after the war in Afghanistan. And you get the sense, and Ambassador Freed was relating how, you know, at the time in the 80s, people in Moscow were whispering in the ears of Western diplomats, this can't go on, this can't go on, this is going to change sooner or later. And one has to wonder if we are approaching that point now, or if that is just too far into the future. I know Ambassador Freed also had a very nice piece in the Atlantic Council on this. What do you think about that, Vladimir?
I think in terms of theatrics, the parallels with the embassy expulsions, the parallels to 86 are quite evident. Mm-hmm. But I think it has more of a domestic dimension for mm-hmm. Russia, because it really allows the Russian authorities to look very tough, very decisive in defense of their interests, without actually hurting the United States too much. And without essentially jeopardizing the prospects for the relationship. But in terms of the substance of the foreign policy, I think I would agree with Mark that it's more the late 70s mm-hmm. than the late 80s, because Moscow has not yet gotten stuck into the kind of quagmire that the Soviet Union got itself entrapped in Afghanistan. I think even with the parallels that Dan Fried is making with the Russian adventures in Ukraine and Syria, those are not exactly the same kind of death traps that mm-hmm. Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union. And so there is still some conscious effort to avoid such entanglements. But at the same time, to raise the flag and to ratchet up the level of military confrontation, that would serve two objectives. One would force the West, particularly the United States, to pay attention to what Russia is doing and saying. And then to appear to the Russian public that that Russia is a great power again and Russia's interests are taken seriously.
So you don't see in the Moscow elite now even kind of voices that are not public but are feeling this way, that this can't go on and this has to change. You don't see any of that yet?
Not yet. I wouldn't go as far as to say that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Angela, any thoughts on this?
Well, I was going to say, there's a dimension that no one's mentioned that's very different from 1986, and that is the international situation is different, and Russia now has a relationship which seems to be getting stronger steadily with China, which gives it options that I would say didn't have in 1986. So, you know, obviously the relationship with China enabled Russia to avoid isolation, the kind of isolation that the U.S. and Europe wanted to impose on it after the annexation of Crimea and the war in the Donbass. And that relationship, even though, you know, we can say it's instrumental and there's a wariness there, but still it's a pretty strong relationship. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the kind of imperative for Russia to improve ties to the West, you know, it doesn't look the same today as it did in 1986. So, that, you know, of course there are people in the Russian elites who would like Russia not to have this kind of confrontational relationship with the West, and Alexei Kudrin and other people have been quite, you know, explicit about it, and even, I guess, Yevgeny Primakov, before he died, sort of hinted at the same thing. But I just think Russia has different options today that it didn't have before, and seems to be, with China, so fixated on, you know, creating a new world order where both of those countries have a much more equal say. And then you have a U.S. president, by the way, that also doesn't seem to be very committed to the kind of post-Cold War liberal international order and all of those things. So I think because of that, maybe the imperatives aren't the same now as they were before.
Yeah, you certainly have a much stronger China right now. Although you, at the same time, you have a China that's playing its own game there. Mark, you wanted to jump in before we shift gears.
Just a last little kind of historical footnote on those points. If you think of those three crises that led to reform and rapprochement, Crimea in 1905, and then sort of end of Afghanistan or arguably the loss of the Cold War. Crimea, during the Crimean War, Nicholas I dies, conveniently enough. After the Russo-Japanese War, you have Stalypin coming in as prime minister. And, of course, even as the Afghan War is being played out in its last years, Gorbachev.
The crucial thing is
this confluence. Now, in some cases, obviously, the failure leads to, I mean, obviously, sort of the growing signs of defeat in the Cold War was one of the crucial elements behind Gorbachev's election, for example.
Right.
But that is, I think, is the key point. And this is what I mean. I mean, I think there is a large reservoir of people, not just Kudrin, who are thinking, actually, there are problems with the current status quo. But so long as there is no evidence of any kind of change in the White House, in the Kremlin, I think that remains an unrealized potential.
Yeah. Well, no, it's interesting. Without validating the kind of the paranoid feeling in Moscow that Vladimir outlined there about how the belief that forcing a change in policy is really an attempt to force regime change, I don't think we're going to get policy change without regime change, although that's not going to happen as a result of anything the West does. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at another source of tension between Moscow and Washington. Russia's gearing up to hold its largest military exercises since the Cold War. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from lovely Nantucket, Massachusetts, is Angela Stent, a former official with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Intelligence Council, and currently the director of Georgetown University's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies. And joining us from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian foreign ministry official, a columnist for Republic RU, and president of the Left Group. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Курс на Запад 2017.
Россия и Белоруссия активно готовятся к самым большим военным учениям.
Больше военнослужащих, чем официально заявлено.
А белорусско-российские учения являются демонстрацией
постоянства.
As if the escalating diplomatic standoff between Moscow and Washington wasn't enough, there may be a military challenge on the horizon as well. Russia's gearing up for its largest military exercises since the Cold War. Western officials estimate that as many as 100,000 troops will hold war games in Belarus and Western Russia near the borders of NATO members Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The Zapad 2017 exercises are scheduled for mid-September, but they're already making people nervous in Tallinn, Riga, Vilnius, and Warsaw, not to mention Washington and Brussels. A pretext for mischief, saber-rattling, a message to the neighbors, a message to the West, a very expensive and noisy psyop, business as usual. Mark?
Well, I'm going to treat that as a sort of a buffet question.
It's a buffet. That was my intention.
It is several of those things. But first and foremost, it is a military exercise.
Yeah.
It is part of a regular process, and the Russians have learnt their lessons that, in fact, you have to train hard in order to be able to have proper fighting capacity. And so they carry out a lot of military exercises, and therefore we shouldn't be surprised. This is not something that they've just suddenly dreamed up or whatever. But
although they only hold these things periodically, the Zapad exercises are huge exercises.
But this is part of the cycle. It's not as if they suddenly pulled this out of their back pocket. Mm. But at the same time, of course, they're also going to try and make most use of it for what I've called in a paper for the European Council on Foreign Relations, heavy metal diplomacy, essentially using their exercises as a form of coercive diplomacy. So at the same time as it's actually quite useful for us to watch how they war game, because they will essentially try and carry out their war game the way they would imagine fighting a proper war, mm. at the same time they are inevitably going to tweak it. They want us to be scared. Mm-hmm. They want the West to be concerned and to have all these terrible scenarios about Russian troops storming through the Suwalki Gap and all that, because it's part of this dark power that gives Putin a certain amount of geopolitical leverage.
Now, one has to remember, too, that the Kavkaz war games in 2008 happened right before what? The invasion of Georgia.
True. They were going to happen anyway, and in a way, sort of, the Georgia thing was part
of the
cycle.
What was going to happen? The invasion? Kavkaz,
it was clear that the invasion was eventually going to happen, but no, Kavkaz games. So, I think that we have to sort of treat it. Now, of course, the interesting thing is actually what elements do they throw in precisely to try and put political leverage? Mm. Whom do they target? We've seen in the past there are simulated nuclear attacks and so forth. I can't help but wonder if the Swedes and the Finns, who after all are still toying with but probably not going to go for NATO membership, are going to get some little sort of simulated warning of this is what's going to happen. I think obviously, yes, they're going to try and maximise the domestic PR, lots of tanks and so forth on TV, as well as the foreign coercive diplomacy. Mm. But primarily, this is a military exercise. And finally, I don't think it's likely that there's going to be some kind of stay behind. You know, they're going to stay in Belarus.
Yeah.
A, I mean, it's clear Belarus has made it clear that it's not happy with the idea. And also, I mean, apart from the fact that whether that issue would have any real sort of function, it would actually necessitate constructing a whole load of really quite expensive facilities and logistical support at a time when the defense budget is already under pressure.
That is not stopping the conspiracy theorists. If you look on Facebook, I've seen numerous things on Facebook. The little green men have already appeared in Belarus. People with putting photos of supposed little green men running around Belarus have been unable to confirm that in any way, shape, or form. But I did raise the Kavkaz thing for a reason, because it's being raised by people in the Baltics who are extremely nervous about this situation right now. I also find it significant. I just read this morning that Belarus has invited Latvia and Estonia to observe, which is quite interesting.
But this is it. I mean, it demonstrates to me this point that, I mean, on the one hand, of course, yes, there are Russian service personnel in Belarus, not just because of the common air defense base, but also, I mean, actually, these big exercises involve a lot of prep. Mm. And there's a whole variety of other.
So these are the little green men that people are supposedly seeing, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there were indeed Russians already on the ground carrying out various things. But it is very clear. I mean, Belarus has already made it clear that it actually any little green men and any people who look like aggressors not showing insignia will be treated as aggressors. Mm-hmm. In an interesting kind of parallel with actually the sort of statements which we've seen from NATO. I think it is clear that the Belarus would not be amenable to this. And therefore, mm-hmm. it's a question of whether or not actually Russia wants, in effect, to occupy Belarus. Mm. I think it's a bit busy at the moment.
Yeah. Angela, you want to jump in here? How do you see these exercises playing out? And what do you see?
I don't really have much to disagree with what Mark said. I mean, you gave us all the various options. I think it's most of the above. I mean, I think, again, the domestic message is very important for the Russian people in the lead up to the election. You know, Russia's strong. You know, we're militarily strong. Nobody can threaten us. I mean, I think it's clearly, you know, Russia showing its ability to project power. It's business as usual, in as much as, you know, these exercises have been going on periodically for some time. I remember one recently, one of the Zapads, where I believe, you know, Lithuania was quote unquote the aggressor and everything got very tense. It's certainly a message to Russia's neighbors. You know, sort of the potential for intimidation. But I also think that, and I've seen the same Facebook posts as you have, that it's an exaggeration to think this is a prelude to an invasion of Belarus. I mean, Russia doesn't need to do that. It already has a military relationship with Belarus. It has a fairly deep, even though not without tensions, relationship with Belarus. But I think it certainly feeds into the narrative that you've seen from the Baltic states, you know, since 2014, of the potential, you know, for Russia really to threaten them, and all the scenarios you've seen, the RAND Corporation and all these people mm-hmm. who've done scenarios saying if there were a conflict between Russia and the Baltic states, there's actually not too much anyone could do about it. So I think, again, it's probably reminding the NATO countries of the limits of Article 5. But I think the main message is, I mean, it's a military exercise, as Mark says, and you do them and you have to prepare for them. That's a normal thing. Most countries, you know, with large militaries do that. And I think it's just, you know, a message to Russia's neighbors.
Yeah. No, I mean, we really didn't need the RAND Corporation study to tell us that the Baltic states are pretty much indefensible if Russia wants to take that piece of real estate. All we can do is raise the costs. On the Belarus piece, I think there was a time when there were legitimate concerns that these exercises might be used for the pretext of to do something, not necessarily occupy Belarus, but when Lukashenko was playing footsie with the West, and he still continues to hold out and not giving Russia that airbase it wants, when Lukashenko looked like he was moving into a more contentious relationship with Moscow, with these exercises approaching, then there were concerns. Since then, he's kind of reeled back a bit. But Lukashenko is ever the gamer. And you have to wonder, and this invitation to the Estonians and Latvians to observe is extremely interesting. Vladimir, how's this look from Moscow? How do you see Moscow using these exercises in the context of everything we've been talking about here?
I think there is too much hype over this exercise. It's been pre-planned, as Mark puts it correctly. And one significant aspect of it is that since it's this year it's on Belarus territory, the exercise is taking place on Belarus territory. It's the Belarusian general staff that is in the lead role in writing the scenario for the exercises. And actually, the Russian deployments to Belarus for the exercise would be limited to a relatively small contingent, a few thousand troops. Most of the larger force would be deployed in the western parts of Russia. And here, I think the significant element is that the permanent deployments of new Russian forces and redeployments of Russian forces to the western. To the Western Front were essentially geared towards the Ukraine theater. Mm-hmm. It's in the south southeast around Rostov, and it's in the northwest, essentially creating staging grounds for possible contingencies involving Ukraine, but not the Baltics. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the ground fighting units of the Russian Western military districts in the vicinity of the Baltics, and particularly in Kaliningrad, the actual ground fighting units have not been significantly modernized. Kaliningrad has just one tank battalion. The Russians invested in anti-access, anti-air denial capabilities and deployed some sophisticated air defense systems and coastal defense systems, but not any large number of main battle tanks or whatever it takes to, you know, to take and hold the terrain. Yeah. So I think the Baltics should not be really worried about this exercise.
Yeah, we've all seen those scary A2A2
with Belarus, you know, the fears of those green men. I think there is a constituency in Minsk, within the Minsk elites, who want to play this threat of Russian green men appearing and staying to increase their leverage with President Lukashenko and to increase their sway on policies. And so I think we should take that with a certain, with a little bit, with a grain of salt, the kind of speed we get from certain circles in Minsk on this exercise. I think that it's ridiculous to claim that the Russians would try to invade Belarus. Belarus is a Russian military ally, and Lukashenko maintains a very tight grip on power. The only scenario I can envision a Russian invasion of Belarus would be under, you know, a color revolution scenario in which Lukashenko essentially calls Moscow for help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're not there yet.
Yeah, there's a lot of agendas at work here. And you're right, Vladimir, to point out that the major movement of Russian troops have been to the Ukrainian border, which I've been taking note of with a bit of alarm over the past several weeks. Mark, looking at this, what are you looking for? What will you be watching for? I mean, because everybody's going to be watching this, right? What are you going to be watching for?
Again, let's put it on two levels. In terms of the immediacy, it is a question of precisely where are they moving their strike forces? I mean, they've been creating this Guards Tank Army in the Western Military District. You know, if we see unexpected movements of the kind of forces who precisely would be used to spearhead an attack, I don't believe that for a minute, but nonetheless, that's something that we'll keep an eye out for, which, you know, over and above what we'd anticipate within the sort of the norms of the scenario. So that's the kind of the short-term thing. The main thing is precisely to look at this exercise as an opportunity to see, first of all, how Russia thinks it would fight a major land war, which is not necessarily always going to be on its western flank. It could actually be somewhere else, to the east or the south. So, you know, it's actually a great opportunity because they have to basically train the way they fight. So we'll get a chance to see that, see how well they do. But also, I think particularly to see what political narrative they try and build around it. I think it's going to be actually the propaganda around it, or, you know, whether it's in terms of precisely, you know, who are the nasty aggressors and which sort of purely simulated imaginary cities do they happen to bomb that might look particularly like Stockholm or Tallinn or whatever. You know, that'll tell us something about precisely their political intent. Who is it that they feel they need to lean on, or that they feel might actually be in a position in which a bit of a push has some impact?
Mm. Vladimir, Angela, what will you be watching for as we wrap it up here?
Well, I would just, I mean, I agree with Mark. I think that we did not, not have to see exactly what the scenario is and whom they're directing their attention against and toward. So I think that would be one of the more interesting aspects of it.
Whom they're trying to intimidate. Vladimir, last word to you before you wrap it all up.
I would be watching if the scenario, the scenario for the exercise envisions Russian effort to defend Kaliningrad. How do the Russians plan to defend? Because it's a very vulnerable proposition. It's in a very vulnerable spot. And whether this defense of Kaliningrad would essentially involve, you know, counteroffensive or offensive operations like, you know, closing this Suwalki gap.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. We think of the Baltics as being very vulnerable, and you pointed out that it is, in fact, also Kaliningrad that's vulnerable. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Nantucket, Massachusetts, has been Angela Stent, a former official with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Intelligence Council, and currently director of Georgetown University's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies. And joining us from Moscow has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, a former Russian foreign ministry official, a columnist for Republic.ru, and president of the Left Group. Thank you all for a very enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
Always here, too. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take next week off because I will be on vacation and because, well, it is August. But we'll be back in 2 weeks on August 18th. Until then, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.